Welcome to WRTI's Classical Stream, made possible by contributions from listeners like you. Learn more at WRTI.org.
We have with us today a dear friend and a wonderful flutist, Robert Stallman. Welcome once again to
Great to be back, Jill.
With Bob, we have not only a great musician, but someone who is so informed. And I'm saying this in front of him because he is a historian. When he does a recording, he not only knows the music, but he knows the background so very, very well, and he feels it very, very intensely. And I think this particular new album, which is very exciting, The Nightingale in Love, on the Bogner's Cafe label, which is Bob Stallman's label. And this is a new album that is absolutely delightful. Very intimate, you said, very personal.
Yes, it is. The music, it's a very interesting period in French history. It's the period of the Regency, the period between the Sun King, Louis XIV,
yes,
and Louis XV, who at this point is just a child and is not yet able to ascend the throne. So the Duke d'Orléans, the Duke of Orleans, is the king for the moment. He's the regent king. And because of all the repressions and suppression of the king's government at Versailles, and on top of that, scandals and two wars and the treasury totally depleted of their gold, and famine and a plague, and the people totally distressed.
And you name it, they had it, of course.
Sounds a little familiar, but it was France in the 1700s, early 1700s. Well, at this point, because of this kind of cultural cauldron that was created by all the historical situations at that time, at the turn of the century of 1700, the arts start to flourish very, very, very quickly. Not that it happened overnight, but actually during Louis XIV's last years. Now, he lived until 1715, and this music on this recording is basically from 1701 to 1733. 1733 is the year that Couperin, the greatest composer of all of the Baroque, dies. So what happened was at the court of Louis XIV, Lully, the famous,
yes, the very famous,
very famous and rather pompous Italian
court
transplant
conductor. Actually.
Yes, he was the of the chapel and of the king's musicians. He was the actual title, I don't know, but he was the
big guy,
superintendent, the director.
Okay,
but to protect his territory, they had it, not just Lully, but the king and his people had it, so that music must basically, it has to be expressed through words. You don't have sonatas and trios yet, although, of course, in Italy they'd had this for a long time, and the violin had already become more important, or as important as the voice in some ways. But in France, this was taboo. The voice was it. The written word was the expression. The music tried to help the poetry along or the religious text along. And so there were all these rules. You know, the French are very good at rules.
They were completely governed by rules.
Yeah, rules. And the court at Versailles, as we read about it, it's astonishing. It was so regimented and so silly, really.
It was impossible.
You know, impossible.
Yes, yes.
So you have these composers on this recording. You have Couperin, Philidor, much lesser known, de la Barre, the first French virtuoso of the flute,
Marais,
the great da gamba virtuoso, and Beaumarchais, who was not a flutist, who was just a composer, but wrote prolifically for the flute. You have them all basically working at the court. Let's say during the day, this is in Versailles, and to get there took many, many hours,
right,
by horse, by carriage. And then coming back at night to Paris from two extreme kinds of social climates.
Yes.
But, of course, they had fun in Paris because now the music was happening in the salons of the grand maison, the hotels, or the mansions, especially on the left bank, those imposing mansions with courtyards that are still there, of course, in Paris. And they're also happy in the new cafes. Coffee had been brought to Paris. Le Procope was the first coffee house. Vienna got it first from the Turks.
Yes, and then
it came to Paris and then to London, almost simultaneously, London and Paris. And it just exploded, not only for music was it a cultural revolution, but for literature and for journalism and for all the arts.
So they were so regimented at the court, but they had to write according to the rules of the court.
Basically, Lully wrote music that glorified the king.
Yes.
So he wrote a lot of music with trumpets and tambour,
yes,
you know, drums.
Right.
And fanfares and, you know, suites. There were strings and all, but it was always rather regal and pompous. He also wrote some beautiful religious music, because the king and his, I want to say girlfriend, but she was actually his wife, Madame de Maintenon. They were married privately, secretly, I should say. His mistress was very devoutly religious Catholic. So, but beyond that, the idea of a violin playing a sonata with harpsichord was not in their taste, but it was very much in the taste of the composers on this recording and of Couperin. Now, at the same time, you have Watteau, the great painter, who changes. He and Couperin music, Watteau in the visual arts, changed the whole landscape of French culture, and so quickly, because the people were so ready for it. They saw these beautiful paintings of
Watteau
with all the dream,
yes,
the dreamscapes the and the imagination,
yes, uh-huh,
and also the social satire involved in the paintings. Mm-hmm. Now, it's absolutely mirrored by what Couperin did with his harpsichord pieces, because many of his pieces are little digs at specific people of the court or in the aristocracy. They're parodies of people.
But you see, Couperin, you're talking about Le Grand, because there was this whole family of Couperin.
Well, this is François Couperin Le Grand, the greatest.
Yes. Uh-huh.
His uncle was Louis Couperin, another outstanding composer.
Now, didn't he also write these tragédies, you know, the dramas, the court entertainments?
Not that, no. He wrote, when he played for the king, he wrote religious music, and his daughter, one of his daughters, was a very fine soprano, and she sang almost always his religious music in the Versailles Chapel. When he played for the king, it was basically solo harpsichord, or it could be with gamba and with voice. And yeah, I'm not saying that strictly that they never played instrumental music, but it was not the thing to do for the king. But as the king got more and more depressed, he became more of a recluse, and he only had the music in his private chambers. So here is Couperin playing harpsichord with the king, you know, probably stretched out on a divan, on a divan,
okay,
or something. Listen.
So what year are you talking about?
Well, we're talking about between 1690 and 1715, when the king, the Sun King, dies.
This new album is really a unique one in your repertoire, because it is very, very intimate, as you said, very specific. And what was the whole thought behind this when you decided to do this?
Well, the title, in a way, is the emblem of the feeling of the music, because the nightingale, for the French, and probably for most of Europe at this point in the early part of the 1700s, was the symbol of love and of personal expression of love. But the nightingale has a kind of a wistful and a haunting call in the night. And in the 18th century, it was very common. I mean, people talk about going to the woods in France in the 1700s and hearing many nightingales all night. Not, you know, if we heard one now, if you were in Italy and heard one, it'd be fantastic. But now,
but then
it was like choruses of nightingales.
Okay.
And the nightingale, sort of epitomized this kind of melancholic and
longing
for, let's say, for a lost love. And the piece that ends this recording, The Nightingale in Love, is the famous Couperin harpsichord piece that he offers to the flutist. He said at the in a footnote at the end of the manuscript, if my nightingale is played by the flute, it can do no better.
Now, but the nightingale is in love, according to
you. The nightingale is in love. And I think this is a personal, possibly autobiographical piece of Couperin, that who the object of his love is, we don't know. It may have been his wife. It may have been a mistress. It may have been some unapproachable person. But there's obviously a lot of lost, feeling of loss and longing in this piece.
So you named the album this because of the kind of music that is being played. Is, of course, it's of a specific period, from 1700 to 1731, you said?
It's roughly from 1700 to 1733 when Couperin dies.
Okay. Yeah. So you already have, we have set the stage with a France in decline.
Yes, well, we were talking about that, and the need for a renaissance, and it happens very quickly once the Sun King sort of recedes. He's still alive, but he's sort of receded into his chambers, and he's not seen much at all. And the people are restless; they want something new and invigorating, and they want a sense of joie de vivre. You know, they want to feel like they're alive again.
So there's a change in the expression of art.
Art becomes very important, and it becomes a vehicle, especially music, for self-expression.
Joseph Baudin de Boismortier. Tell us a little bit about him.
Briefly, he was not a flutist. He was probably a harpsichordist. He wrote reams of music for flute. Why? Because it was very good business. There was a huge market for it.
Lots of flute in France.
Lots of flute. At the same time, it all came together because the flute supersedes almost overnight. Supersedes the recorder, the blockflute.
Yes, yes.
Because the Hautetaire family had just improved the instrument.
I was going to ask you about that because wasn't there a change?
Of course,
you
needed the instrument to have the audience and the interest. And so people said, "Oh my gosh!" Now when I hear, as he said, "Mon Dieu," when I hear de la Barre play, it's almost like a violin. He can play all these, you know, up the scale, the arpeggio. Okay. He's a virtuoso. It never could happen before on the old flute. So there was an excitement about it. And then the amateurs are taking lessons, and there are treatises by Hautetaire and by de la Barre on how to play the flute and da-da-da. And at the same time, Marais on the viola da gamba, who's already done this, he's already established that instrument, it's still there, the gamba. But the violin is sort of still taboo. It's not allowed into France quite yet. It comes in with Leclerc about this time, but it takes, I don't know, 10, 20 years by 1720s or 30s, it's established. Whereas, of course, in Italy, it was already established.
That's very interesting. So, in other words, wind instruments were important at that point.
The flute had an appeal because of its sound. It's the closest to the human voice. The violin can do more expressively, but the flute is the closest. It resembles a voice. You breathe, you play. There's nothing between you and the sound. It's just you're blowing across the top of the embouchure. There's no reed.
It's one of the oldest instruments.
And it's the oldest instrument except for the drum that we know of. But it had this kind of rooted connection in the people's feeling in France. And it's also delicate, virtuosic, melancholic, and sensitive and tender. These are all the elements that make up for gallantry in France. And gallantry does not mean to be gallant. In French, and especially at that time, it had to do with really being
tasteful,
seductive, actually.
Oh.
It had to do with being amorous, but doing it in a very decorous way. Very elegant, witty, sensitive, dashing, but not too much. Subtle, and also very cultivated, that it was very important to play an instrument, for example, to paint. Now, Philippe d'Orléans, who was the regent, played the flute. Watteau played the flute. They're amateurs. Interesting. Philippe painted. He was a very talented painter. His paintings are still in Paris in the Palais, in the Tuileries. And he also was exploring chemistry. He had a chemistry laboratory in his palace. This is a kind of Renaissance.
Very cultured man,
very interesting, very liberal and libertine figure. Fascinating to read about him.
Now, was the flute the transverse flute, or was it this?
Yeah, the transverse flute. It's a wooden instrument.
Which is the one that is played horizontally, I guess, as opposed to
unless you're lying down.
Well, as opposed to a recorder type.
Exactly. It's played crosswise.
So this was already a modification of the old flute.
Well, see,
wasn't the
Renaissance flute was a cross flute, but it didn't have the possibility of a tonal range and colors and technique. It could just play very simple melodies.
So this was already a very sophisticated instrument. And
well, we would not say sophisticated. There was only one key on it.
Oh.
I mean, you know, historically, the Baroque people in music now, they play these instruments, and they spend a lot of time just to get the notes in tune or close to being in tune. It's not so easy. The idea of playing an even scale is almost an impossibility.
Really?
Yeah. Not that it wasn't wanted. It just couldn't really be done. Because some notes are beautifully round and fat. Other notes are just weak and hollow. And that's why you have often an embellishment on the weak notes to hide that fact.
Isn't that interesting? So you had one key. Now the flute has how many keys?
Well, I never counted, but there are, I don't know. I should know, but I don't.
All kinds of keys.
I think at least about 13 or something.
Okay. So this is all rather important as to the kind of music that was written at the time.
Yeah. So this is the first time you hear a virtuoso on the flute. You'd heard it on the harpsichord. You heard it on of course, the gambas and all the viol family, but never on a wind instrument. And Delabarre is really the first one who was considered a virtuoso, followed by Michel Blavet, who's somebody I've also recorded. His sonatas are quite brilliant. And then on the violin and the flute, Leclerc, because he wrote sonatas that could also be played on the flute.
Now, this particular album, though, includes music of, as you said before, Couperin, Delabarre, Marais, Philidor, and Boismortier. They are specific to that certain period, is that right?
Exactly. And they all knew each other. And there was a sort of a collegiality, kind of a friendship between them, which is also very interesting.
So the closeness, the personal quality of this album is very, very indicative of what was going on generally there.
In a sense, they were I don't want to say they were rebels, but they were radicals, and so they kind of hung together. There was a bond between Couperin and Marais and Delabarre. That we know for sure. About Boismortier, I'm not sure about that. But Marais, Couperin, and Delabarre definitely, and Philidor, knew each other and respected each other and kind of looked out for each other.
Now, what is rather interesting also, aside from the composers that you have on this album, is your dedication of this album to someone that you worked with and loved and learned from.
Well, Jean-Pierre Rampal was my one of my teachers and my mentor, and this is the 10th anniversary of his death this year, 2010. And he was the one who introduced me to just about, well, almost all the music on this recording. I either studied with him or heard him play. And I remember having a recording, I still have it, an LP on the Dover label. From probably the late 60s, mid-60s, of the Philidor and the Delabarre. And I just fell in love with those two pieces. So when I made this request, I'm going to definitely put those two on this program.
Now, when you just generally about your label, Bogner's Cafe, there's a specific direction that you're going in with the kind of material that you're producing and recording.
Well, it's about chamber music that was heard in cafes in Europe in the 18th century.
So you're moving out of the royal residences, I guess, into the life of the
people. We're not going to tie ourselves to just that. But basically, the idea is we're presenting music to our listeners in a hypothetical setting of a cafe, of an intimate surrounding. We're not in a hockey arena or, you know, in Shea Stadium. We're not outdoors. We're in an intimate setting. You're about 15 feet from the music, 10 feet.
Well, also, a lot of the instruments I know, like the clavichord, I was surprised to learn that you could never really hear it beyond, say, the sixth or seventh row.
I couldn't. It's so faint.
It's a very, very, yeah, very, very yeah. delicate sound. Yeah. So here we are with this Nightingale in Love. But what you have certainly brought to us, Robert Stallman, is yet another very precious album of a very important period, certainly in the flute literature and music in general. Thank you so much, and we look forward to another enlightening album from you.
Always a great pleasure, Jill. Thank you.
Great.
We've been speaking with Robert Stallman, virtuoso flutist and, I would say, musicologist at this rate. A very, very interesting album, The Nightingale in Love, music of the French court of the early 1700s.